If you have hyperthyroidism or Hashimoto's and are looking to save your thyroid, then you might want to take the 60-second Save My Thyroid quiz to find out how likely it is that you can save your thyroid. Upon completing the quiz, you will receive your thyroid saving score and a free report explaining your unique results, along with some things you can do to regain your health. To take the quiz, visit savemythyroid.com/quiz. Thank you for joining me on the Save My Thyroid podcast, where I help people save their thyroid and regain their health. My name is Dr. Eric Osansky, and if you have hyperthyroidism, including Graves' disease or toxic multinodular goiter, then you will especially benefit from these episodes. If you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you also need to save your thyroid, and therefore you will also find many of the episodes to be valuable, including this one, where I interview Nicholas Pinot, as we have an amazing conversation about the concerns with electronic pollution. If you're like me and you're interested in doing everything you can to minimize EMF exposure, you will absolutely love this episode. And if you're skeptical about the impact of EMFs, I think you'll find this conversation to be eye-opening. I also want to mention that as of doing the interview, Nick is hosting an upcoming summit that focuses on EMFs. And so if you want even more information, you can register by visiting savemythyroid.com/EMF event. As usual, make sure you listen to the post-episode chat after the outro music, as I'll expand on safe doses of EMFs, shielding, EMFs and fertility, EMFs and thyroid cancer, EMFs and sleep disruption, hiring a building biologist, and aura rings. And you can access the show notes by visiting savemythyroid.com/137. Anyway, here's my interview with Nicholas Pinot.
Welcome to the Save My Thyroid podcast, hosted by Dr. Eric Osansky. To stay up to date on the latest thyroid health-related topics, visit savemythyroid.com. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking with your doctor. Now let's head to the show.
So I am super excited to chat with Nicholas Pinot as we are going to be chatting about EMF hazards and, of course, tying them into thyroid health, and going to be an awesome conversation here. So let me go and dive into Nick's impressive bio. So Nick, the EMF guy, Pinot, is the number one best-selling author of The Non-Tinfoil Guide to EMFs and an advocate for safe technologies. Through his unconventional approach, blending humor, science, and common sense, he's become a leading voice on the topic of electromagnetic pollution and how it affects our health. For the last few years, Nick has been interviewing some of the best minds on health and technology and facilitating the creation of courses and educational materials to raise awareness on this very important issue. And you can find more about Nick at theemfguide.com. And thank you so much for joining us, Nick.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, this is a fascinating topic and something that affects everyone, of course. And I want to start a little bit with your background. So how did you start focusing on helping others becoming more aware of the problem with electronic pollution?
My journey started in 2010 when I got into nutrition, but quickly diverged into environmental toxins. Because yes, I discovered that many people can argue online about what is the best diet, but we can all agree that if you add glyphosate or, you know, other pesticides, herbicides, or heavy metals in your food, that's nothing good. And also, some people realized by then that there's plenty of scientific research that shows we're impacted by these toxins at very low levels. It also showed me and made me a little bit blasé about the current state of regulatory agencies. I realized that these substances are not properly regulated in a sense that the public is not completely protected against these health hazards, especially when they are cumulative and then act in synergy. Another toxin I came across later in my career as a citizen journalist is electropollution. And that was new for me because I had heard a little bit about, you know, the dangers of putting a phone to your head and maybe the risks of brain tumor, but I had no idea that hundreds of independent scientists, and some of them had very prestigious careers in other types of pollution. And these hundreds of scientists were pretty much saying the same thing. We need more research. We're underfunded and systematically defunded, in fact. So the more you find negative health effects linking cell phones' poor health the less you get funding, which it should have been the opposite, where, you know, urgent funding, additional funding from the government or health agencies. So I was very alarmed by the fact that we should be studying this technology more, and we're doing it less and less. And at the same time, we are increasing our exposure. And this led me to write my book in 2017, The Non-Tinfoil Guide to EMFs. And I really chose that title and that angle because I realized, my God, in among many skeptics, that even those in functional medicine that understand environmental toxins, a lot of them did not take EMF seriously. And part of the reason is there's a lot of confusion online. Some of it is straight up incorrect. A lot of it is fear-mongering. But then you got these opposite side of the coin that is, oh, there's no effect. This is non-ionizing radiation. It does nothing to the human body. It will not interfere with your sleep. It will not give you a brain tumor. There's nothing to see here. And I think these two positions that are at the extremes are completely incorrect. And I tried to make sense of, okay, what are these scientists actually saying? What can we safely say about these dangers, and how do we communicate them? And there's not a lot of certainty around EMFs. People are looking for certainty. How dangerous are these, Nick? How long should I use my phone safely, right? What is the difference between cell phones and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and these kind of exposures? And the topic is very complicated to communicate on a scientific basis because most of these questions are left unanswered to this day due to the lack of funding and then the systematic defunding of the entire topic.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that and giving that background. And yeah, I think more people, including practitioners, are becoming more open to EMFs. I mean, still, we have a long way to go. Now, you mentioned brain tumor, which I think it's safe to say you probably would agree that probably in most people, EMFs aren't going to cause brain tumors. They could do that potentially, but it goes beyond that. Some people might hear brain tumor and just dismiss it. But I actually listened to some of your past interviews and just talking about some of the effects, like even sleep disruption, even if that alone was a problem, which I think it is, that alone could be a big reason to try to minimize our exposure, conditions like tinnitus. So yeah, if you could talk a little bit about, I guess before we do that, for those who are brand new to EMFs, can you maybe first just talk about what EMFs are, and then maybe we lead into the conversation of maybe some of the concerns like potentially cancer, sleep disruption, and some of the other concerns?
Sure. So there are many different types of EMFs. Of course, the electromagnetic spectrum is very large. It encompasses everything from the Schumann resonance, which is the natural magnetism emitted by the planet Earth, which we actually need on a biological standpoint, up to microwave radiation, which is your cell phone. And we also have visible light. And then we go at the extreme in nuclear radiation. All of these exposures have different dosage that are compatible with the body. But one thing is generally true is that natural exposures tend to be more compatible with our biology. So the sun, visible light, right? We do have a certain dose of sunlight that we can get safely, and then we can get risks or even skin burning and other things that aren't pleasant at all if we get too much sun. But it's understood that these exposures are not only beneficial, they are in fact needed for good health. And now with the vitamin D research that's exploding in the last decades, it shows us that our health is intertwined with the sun cycle, just on a circadian rhythm standpoint, but also vitamin D protection and overall immunity. And researchers think of vitamin D as a hormone now and not even as a vitamin per se. So it's even more profound than that. So we're closely linked with natural EMFs. And there's all the reasons to think that if you tamper with the EMF environment by creating new EMFs in the form of cell phones, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, cell phone towers, smart meters, everything that emits these signals that were essentially never seen in nature in these forms, these intensities and these specific frequencies, then you might get into trouble. And the entire topic of EMF needs to be understood by understanding first that we are bioelectrical being. There's many components of our bodies that need electricity or produce electricity or have sensors that read electricity around the cell or around the mitochondria. And if we understand that and we recognize that we are bioelectrical beings, it makes it at least plausible that if you have a bunch of different random signals around you, that might create confusion on these bioelectrical sensors of the human body. So we're really talking about electromagnetic biointerference, which is not a topic that is often discussed. Engineers are very well aware of electromagnetic interference. And if your cell phone and your neighbor's cell phone talk to each other and it causes disruption and you both drop the call or you hear each other when you shouldn't, well, engineers are going to step in there and say, my God, there's something unacceptable going on. We have poor connectivity or we have crosstalk. We're going to solve it. But in the case of bio interference, not so much, because our safety guidelines are simply based on the wrong assumptions. And these engineers do not have the obligation to minimize the amount of radiation that your devices emit. To the contrary, at the moment, it's almost anything goes because the threshold levels of EMFs that are accepted, especially in the US, Canada, Australia, and most of the Western nations, is so permissive that these engineers go for the maximum amount of emissions. The maximum, why would they choose that, right? It's not to harm people, it's just for better connectivity. And they're not trying to minimize the potential harms or the potential risks. So this is really the situation here, is we're talking about how to more safely use these devices, considering that our safety guidelines are anything but safe at the moment.
Yeah, those are great points. So really, again, there is research out there, but they're not paying attention to the research. And you know, now we have 5G, which is even more powerful. I don't know if 6G is coming in the near future, but like you said, it is coming.
Yeah, well, you know, it never stops. And part of the discussion we need to have is it's not just what we're exposed to right now. It's what we've been exposed before, because previous technologies were also unsafe. And many people focus on 5G. They hear 5G and read things, oh, 5G is dangerous. But they're reading this 5G article on the web on their 4G phone and maybe are under the impression that they're doing good. Well, way before 5G, I wrote my book in 2017. And way before that, you had scientists in the 1980s emitting concerns over the first Nokia phones, the big bricks. So in reality, this topic has always been prone to controversy. And we need to understand that all past technologies and for the moment, all future versions of that technology will be equally unsafe, because we're not basing these safety standards on the right thing, which should be how much disruption are these causing. Instead, they're focused on how much heating are these devices generating on the body, which is the wrong thing to look at.
Okay, so let's talk about how much disruption do they cause, at least according to what you've read and, you know, your research that you've done. You know, how harmful can they be?
Well, there is vast amount of research on EMFs. And the thing that is very concerning to me is that a large fraction of the public, including a lot of engineers or intellectuals, think that there's no studies. I've even been told on Facebook, I think it might have been on a post that I do. And of course, the Facebook comment section is not the most intelligent place for discussions, but it just shows you there's an electrical engineer that told me, Nick, this research you're proposing is BS, right? And in other words, that weren't so kind, because they really thought I was some sort of a snake oil salesman or a scam artist trying to create some elaborate scheme to extract money out of people by creating fear mongering around EMFs. And they said, Nick, there are zero studies showing that this radiation is harmful. And I said, my God, this is bizarre, because if you just go on PubMed, you're going to find at least several thousands. And we can say that some studies show no effect and some do show effects, but at least you can say, to be fair, that it's a mixed kind of literature. But scientists are trying to pull together these studies on different topics, such as, for example, cancer and cell phones. So is there a link between talking on a phone, on the ear, and then different types of cancer of the head and neck, including thyroid cancer, which is increasingly being studied as we speak? Well, it depends on which scientist you ask this question to, but you have groups of scientists, including top epidemiologists that were very, very recognized as great epidemiologists, such as Dr. Anthony Miller, who had great success in his scientific career around environmental pollutants. And he said in 2018 that the data we had was sufficient to reclassify this agent called radio frequency radiation. Radio frequency is cell phones, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth. He said it should be reclassified as a class one carcinogen. That was 6 years ago. So 6 years ago, he said that it should be next to asbestos and cigarette smoking. So if it were reclassified, I think the public perception around these risks would be changed. Because of course, like you said very perfectly, it's not like the entire population will die of a brain tumor. However, since we have nearly every single human being on the planet that uses a phone, if you change a small fraction of a percentage in brain tumors, you're killing a bunch of people. So the more the population is exposed to an agent, the greater the risks if we get it wrong, right? So it's part of the precautionary principle is that if a technology is rolled out to the entire population, how much we assess the risk and the quality of our science needs to go way up compared to an agent that is used occasionally or in certain industries, for example. But now we're talking about exposures to every single human being. And even more than that, we're talking about exposures to everything biological on the planet since we're rolling out these cell towers and now global satellites around the planet, which is, you know, another rabbit hole. But as far as what kind of science do we have besides cancer? Well, there's good reasons to think that our fertility is impaired by these things. So not only might it affect the thyroid hormones, but also if you have a phone in your pocket, you might impact how much, for example, the testes will be producing testosterone. That plus maybe the quality of sperm can go down. And it's still being argued by different scientists, but some of them are quite convinced that there's a direct link between keeping a phone in the pocket and a reduction in fertility and testosterone. So there are men out there that always laugh at, they say, oh, perfect, I don't want any more kids, but they do want their testosterone and they want their longevity as well. So don't disregard these risks. And as far as the thyroid goes, there are links between even just the presence of cell towers and thyroid dysfunction in certain studies. One of them found that you're more likely to get hypothyroidism, which is very rampant these days, as I'm sure you're talking about all the time, if you live within 300 feet, 100 meters of a cell phone base station. The problem is that these days, it's becoming extremely likely that if you live in a city, you will be within this distance of a cell phone station because they're everywhere. And now with 5G, one of the big problems with 5G is the proximity of these antennas to the population. And even if you turn off your own phone, well, if you're exposed to the cell towers, you might get these negative health effects as well. So there are a lot of reasons to also think. I was just looking at a review from 2019 that is called The Possible Global Hazard of Cell Phone Radiation on Thyroid Cells and Hormones. And they said that more research is needed. It tends to be in every study you find on EMFs these days. More research is needed. It's slow, it's tedious, and I think that most of these lines of research will take a few decades to become strong enough. And with enough studies of high quality and independent studies, that we have a conclusion. However, the researchers already said that we think exposure by cell phones may negatively influence the iodine uptake in the thyroid gland or increases temperature effect on the thyroid gland. They also said that the reduction in diameter of thyroid follicles is potentially linked with cell phone radiation. So many of these researchers, they don't talk about public policy. Does it mean cell phones are safe or unsafe? They just put the research out there and they hope that WHO or a large governmental body will pick up these studies and do something with it. But many of them recommend against holding a phone to the head. And it's interesting because this is not what we hear from governments at all. One of the only governments in the world that has been forced by its Supreme Court to communicate these dangers is the Italian government a few years ago. And that was over after the Supreme Court found that a man was killed by a brain tumor and they found causality between the tumor and a cell phone. And they slapped the wrist of the government saying, you will be forced by your own justice to communicate these risks to the population and at least let them know, you know, you can use your phone more safely. If you talk on speakerphone or if you use headphones instead of putting it right next to your thyroid and parotid gland and, you know, auditory nerves and all these delicate structures around your head and neck, if you don't do that, then you're avoiding most of the risks. So right there, you have many scientists and that study the topic argue, well, why aren't we erring on the side of safety while we're waiting for these studies to become conclusive? And what I see online and what I see from skeptics is, no, I want a definitive proof of harm and then I'll do something. This is backwards thinking. It doesn't work in public policy. And we've done that plenty with different agents where agents are rolled out and we say, oh, you know, we don't see big dangers with lead. And then 10 years later, we say, oh, well, we think that we're overexposed. And each 10 year, the level of lead that is considered safe, it goes down. And eventually, I think most scientists agree that there is essentially no level of lead that is acceptable in the body. And yet we do have occasional exposure. So the same with cell phone radiation, we're really far from that because instead of preventatively lowering exposures from phones and maybe putting the cell phone towers a little bit further away from the population in case that these effects exist, we're doing the opposite, bringing the cell towers to the population, making the phone stronger. So it's really where we're doing it massively wrong with this entire story of health effects.
Yeah, that was a great analogy with lead and, like you said, other agents in the past. And as you mentioned, why not just err on the side of caution and be safe rather than take the risk, even if it is controversial? But it's just, like you said, backwards thinking. And so it could affect thyroid hormones. It could affect fertility, including testosterone, potentially also cause thyroid cancer. Is there any evidence that EMFs can play a role in autoimmunity, like compromised immune system and increased susceptibility?
There are several papers showing different effects on immunity. And it's difficult because in many situations, certain exposures, especially when you're studying mice or rats, so in animal models, or even just cell cultures, at certain exposure levels, you find effects such as increasing immunity. And then you find other effects that in certain other conditions, it will be a decrease in immunity. So it looks like in certain situations, we can adapt to the exposure and maybe even the stress of this radio frequency could make us stronger, act like a sort of hormetic stressor, just like heat exposure or cold plunges or exercise. But in other situations, when it's chronic exposure, you see a depression, a down regulation of the immune system at many levels. So as far as autoimmunity, there's not a lot of evidence, but we have certain researchers such as Dr. Trevor Marshall, who is a professor in California of the, I think it's Autoimmunity Research Foundation, if I recall correctly. And he basically ran a study with participants that had various conditions that are autoimmune, including lupus and maybe other autoimmune conditions. I'm not familiar with all of them. And he basically shielded them against this electrosmog at night. And he realized that 90% of them said that they slept much better and started seeing their symptoms of different autoimmune conditions go down. So he concluded himself, he said, this is bizarre because if we believe the statistics, there should be around 3 to 5% of individuals that are electrosensitive and that might be helped by these shielding strategies. So it makes the case that people with autoimmunity are that much more likely to be electrosensitive and feel these effects. And also he said that in the future, an important component of an autoimmune protocol to get people better would be to shield against these external radiation stressors. So that's something very radical to say, but you know, he's been studying the topic for, I think, over a decade now. And he's considered an expert in autoimmunity. I don't think many of his colleagues would necessarily agree because that's almost, you know, a fringe topic to study, but I think it makes sense. Anecdotally, there are many, many functional medicine doctors that I connect with on a regular basis that see these patients come in and they're affected by multiple things. Sometimes they have autoimmune conditions. Some of them have multiple infections. They have low thyroid, hyperthyroid. Sometimes they have 10 different things going on, But one of them that holds true for all patients is that when they start reducing EMF exposure, everything seems to work better. So is it because you're improving sleep and therefore overall healing? It might be one thing. It might be because you're decreasing stress. It might be there are different reasons, but it looks like EMF can worsen almost any condition out there. Just like eating a diet of McDonald's or Wendy's will also do the same, you know? So in that sense, these man-made EMFs are almost the junk food of signals or frequencies, if you will.
Hey, this is Dr. Eric, and if you're looking to do everything you can to save your thyroid gland, in addition to listening to this podcast, there are a few different ways we can help you. First of all, I've written a book on hyperthyroidism called Natural Treatment Solutions for Hyperthyroidism and Graves' Disease, as well as a book called Hashimoto's Triggers, which of course is on Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and you can find both of these on Amazon as well as other websites where books are sold. Second, you could also join my Graves' Disease and Hashimoto's healing community by visiting autoimmunethyroidgroup.com. And finally, if you want to get personal help from me, you could visit the website workwithdrerick.com. Just to let you know, I only see a limited number of new patients each month, and I do require anyone interested to complete a brief online application before working with me. And now back to the show. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say 3-5% of people are electrosensitive?
Well, it depends. Again, different scientists will have different assessments, but I'd say the 3% is very common among scientists that say 3% are hypersensitive. That would be those who have a very hard time with EMFs. And normally these people can pinpoint that certain exposures are causing them massive symptoms, almost like, you know, a celiac person that knows they're celiac and eats bread, they can pinpoint, I ate that bread and now I feel horrible for days on end. So the same thing can be said for about 1-3%, some say 3-5, but also other scientists say there might be a third of the population that has mild to moderate symptoms, including a reduction in sleep, or maybe they feel more depressed, they have a different neuropsychiatric effect, such as anxiety, depression, OCD type behavior. And that might be a third of all adults, but other researchers have predicted that by 2017, that's something I talked about in my 2024 summit on electrosensitivity. By 2017, these two researchers on electrosensitivity had predicted that 50% of the population would be sensitive based on the last studies, all the surveys they did in different countries, and the curve was going up and up like in a hockey stick kind of graphic there. So they predicted, they asked the question in 2006, they said, will we all become electrosensitive and be sickened by this technology? And I don't know the answer to that. However, many doctors and even average lay people that are fairly healthy change their habits around technology and start feeling better. So there's this difficulty to assess how much EMF is contributing to my own health challenges or even is preventing me from reaching my full potential. If I feel very well right now, do I feel 80% in reality of what I'm missing, this extra 20% because of these exposures? And if you cut down on EMF, turn off Wi-Fi at night, turn off your phone, some of them realize I sleep much better. I thought, you know, I had reached the peak of my health, but it turns out that some of these gadgets around me were keeping me down. And now I have my full potential. The same thing is seen in many professional athletes that know about the topic. So I think increasingly they're going to be interested in the topic, although it's tough because some of them are using sensors and a lot of EMF things to perform better. So it's all a balance, I guess, of especially, you know, not necessarily having these things with you at night. But I think that in the future, we'll see EMF being, you know, part of the discussion about the factors that we need to at least control in our environment.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned turning off devices before going to bed, because if someone's having sleep issues, that's something I definitely bring up. I mean, we're so quick to take supplements like melatonin and, you know, other supplements to help with sleep, but a lot of people overlook the impact of going on the computer an hour before going to bed or on their cell phone and keeping their Wi-Fi plugged in at night. So those are simple changes, just unplugging the Wi-Fi every night, or having a switch, like a timer, just to automatically turn it off and turn it back on in the morning. Would you say, ideally, I guess you probably would say maybe like a couple of hours before going to bed, like people should stop being on devices in a perfect world? I know it's not a perfect world, but maybe like 2 hours or?
Yeah, well, there are many aspects to this. Not only is radio frequency radiation, so the radiation that connects your phone to a cell tower, not only is this impacting your melatonin, possibly, and shifting your brain waves in a way that is not conducive to great sleep. In fact, it will cause sleep onset delay. So you're trying to go to sleep, but you toss and turn, and your brain is not really going in the right type of brain waves that it needs to go in order to fall into your first sleep cycle and go into deep sleep and REM and light and kind of cycle through these different cycles throughout the night. So I would say not only is radio frequency a problem, but also the light, the visible EMFs that are emitted by devices. So I would say 2 hours before bed is good, but I personally advocate for the use of blue blocking glasses that can help mitigate some of the problem with light. And then in the scope of my work, especially during sleep is when you want to absolutely make sure that your cell phone is not, you know, emitting 4G, LTE, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, all these signals under your pillow. And the reality is, you know, you have 75% of the population in some studies that have a cell phone near their pillow. And those that use airplane mode in one study I saw from a few years ago was 20%. So it's still not that popular. I guess 2 out of 10 people made me a little bit happy, I must say, because I thought it might have been 3% of people or something like that, something very depressing, to be honest. But 20% is not enough because we know that it can impact sleep. And then we also know that for some people, it's not just a small impact on sleep. It might be a huge impact. And there are genetic differences, and there are also health status differences in different people. So it looks like the stability of your bioelectrical system also will change with your overall health. And that's just, you know, an overall systems thinking perspective here, where if you're in better health, you're better able to handle occasional things that make you weak, such as alcohol or junk food. And maybe you drink one night and maybe the next day you're fine to go jogging. Whereas someone in extremely poor health or chronic fatigue might do one workout or have one glass of wine and feel very, very fatigued from that same exposure. The same looks like it's true for EMF. So your ability to handle the radiation might be way better if your overall health is better. So that's another reason if you already have autoimmune issues or thyroid issues, you should be more motivated to turn off the EMFs under your pillow. And one thing you could do is just charge your phone in the next room. And I know a lot of parents use their phone as their emergency line for their kids. Maybe they're getting older. They're going out at night for the first time. They don't feel good about turning off the phone at night. They never listen to me. So I tell them, okay, that's fair. But just put it, you know, in the bathroom or on a kitchen table. Somewhere you'll still hear it, but make sure that it's not right next to the pillow. You shouldn't be able to reach out to your phone, and it's just a distraction. And also the radiation it emits will negatively impact your sleep as well.
All the concerns, you mentioned airplane mode, 20% in that study. So if it is in airplane mode and if it's still nearby within arm's reach, is there still concern of some radiation?
It's more complicated than that, unfortunately. You can be on airplane mode and you can still have Wi-Fi on. So you need to not only be on airplane mode, which turns off the cellular antenna, which is the one that connects the towers, but also make sure to turn off Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. So you need to be aware of these things, especially if you have the phone by your bedstand. But if some people use just basic EMF meters, which can help double check your work, if you don't know if your phone is emitting or under which conditions it is emitting radiation, if you have a meter that screams, it shows you, okay, that phone is still emitting a signal. If you have Wi-Fi, it will sound almost like a rifle sound, like doot, 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 doot. If you have Bluetooth, you'll hear clicking. Doot, 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 doot. So if you have these sound indications or even visuals in certain meters that your phone is still emitting, it gives you an indication that you're doing it wrong and you should just go in the menu and turn everything off. And something I can mention that is not for sleep, but a lot of people work nowadays in front of a computer, including myself. I'm in a new environment today and I do have to use Wi-Fi, but in many situations, I'm back home and I use an Ethernet cable to connect my computer to the router. And that's regardless if you have a Wi-Fi router or a non-Wi-Fi router, which most people don't have these days. The reality is that your computer is often much closer to your body and to your thyroid, for that matter, compared to your router. Your router might be in the corner of the home or maybe in the living room next to the TV, or which is often the case. But your computer will emit a fair amount of radiation with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth all day, every day, for hours on end as you're working on a computer. So something that can be extremely positive if you want to reduce your cumulative dose of EMFs is to use these wires to connect your computer. And I know that's a bit of a, some people perceive it as a retrograde idea or, you know, old school, but it's still feasible. And in reality, if you go in businesses, a lot of commercial buildings still use Ethernet cables, and it's still a very great technology to use for rapid data transfer and also cybersecurity, much, much safer on many levels than Wi-Fi. So if you have a home office and you don't like your Wi-Fi and you complain about it, well, hit two birds with one stone right there and just wire up your internet to your computer, and you're going to cut down on radiation and then just have a steady signal that never drops.
Yeah, I'm using Ethernet. It's not just to minimize Wi-Fi, but it's also, like you said, I think it's a better signal. It's just more reliable too. So shielding, you mentioned blue blockers, and then earlier briefly spoke about shielding. So as far as if like you can't get your smart meter removed, or again, to maybe put over your router. So it does sound like you're a supporter of shielding for EMFs.
Yes, cutting down on emissions is way more effective than shielding, because partial shielding might dampen the signal. An example is something that's sold that you can put over your Wi-Fi router, which will dampen the signal 90%. The problem I have with that, and the problem scientists have with that, is that we currently don't even know what is the safe dose of EMFs. So when you have 90% reduction, is it a 90% reduction in biological effects? Is it a 90% reduction in risks? Not necessarily. Is it better than nothing? Well, likely yes, but I'd rather have people at least, even with that, I would turn off Wi-Fi at night, for example, because when it's turned off, you know you're doing good. When you're starting to go into reduction of EMF, such as, you know, lower EMF technologies, some of it, I perceive it as EMF washing, just like greenwashing is, you know, the perception that your product is healthier for the environment, when in reality, you're kind of playing with words. So it's a bit tricky here to talk about how much these are contributing to lowering your exposure. But there are shielding strategies that are more advanced that you can successfully use at home, although they require a larger investment of time and money, such as shielding the bedroom. And increasingly so, certain environmental medicine doctors are recommending these strategies to their patients, where you can completely shield the room, either with a bed canopy over the bed that is made oftentimes of cotton and copper or stainless steel or silver mesh. And these things, it doesn't look like metal. Really looks like fabric that you put over your bed, and it will cut down all the exposures that would have come from the outside. And this is especially important in patients that have this level of sickness, such as autoimmune conditions, or have these levels of exposures that are tremendously high because they live too close to cell phone towers, for example, and they don't feel well in their home. Some people really swear by these different strategies that are applied and also verified by building biologists or EMF mitigation specialists. One of these specialists is my colleague, Brian Hoyer from Shielded Healing. And there are plenty of specialists throughout the world that can come to your home and do a survey. And I recommend it for almost anyone that can afford it, to be honest, because many people tend to fear the towers so much and say, oh, I'm sure this tower, you know, I see it, it's ugly, it's very dangerous, but they don't recognize that all the other things that they have installed inside their home sometimes can be worse than what the tower emits towards their home. So it's sometimes very difficult to assess what exposure is a priority for you. if you don't have the EMF meters and then the expertise to also survey the home for these sources.
What are your thoughts about pendants? There are some that have pendants that supposedly protect you from EMFs, which I've been skeptical of, but it would be great just to put on a pendant. And I'm sure even they wouldn't say that it's completely going to shield you, but do they have any benefit at all in your opinion?
You know, some electrosensitivity sufferers seem to do very well on certain of these technologies, but there's a question, does it play on symptoms, a reduction of symptoms, or is it protective? And this is where you don't really see scientists endorsing these as a magic bullet. And I think that many people are looking for a magic bullet that says, this is tedious, turning off the Wi-Fi at night, or, you know, thinking about the cell phone towers and how much I'm exposed, or this is tedious. Instead, I'll wear something on my person and be completely invincible. This is a nice thought. You know, this is something that is very appealing to our psyche, but it does sound too good to be true, and it is too good to be true, in my opinion. And so far, I've seen different technologies seem to lower some of the biological effects of EMF, such as, for example, certain technologies you could use in your bedroom to sleep better, even in a high EMF environment. Would that be beneficial? Yes. Are you also supposed to turn off the EMF sources in the first place? Yes. So I think if you do both, you're doing yourself a favor. But if you rely solely on these different stickers on the phone and different pyramids and subtle energy devices, I think you're under the illusion of protection and that it's a dangerous game to play. And really, why I'm still taking this position is that since we have indications that some people could be killed by this technology, and that's a big word to use, but if you get a brain tumor and a glioblastoma and you die from your cell phone exposure, that's something extremely sad. And in many, many cases, this has already happened throughout the world. If you are under the illusion that you have a sticker on your phone and you will never get brain cancer from these exposures, and yet in 10 years, you come back to me and say, Nick, I think I'm going to die. I have a brain tumor. I wouldn't feel good about myself because we don't know for sure if it removes any potentially carcinogenic potential of these emissions. We don't know that. So yes, these gizmos and EMF harmonization devices should be explored, especially for people that are electro hypersensitive. But I've seen none of them offer, you know, the magic bullet that many people are looking for.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And before we wrap things up, and I definitely want you to talk about your upcoming EMF Hazard Summit, but I do want to ask you about Oura Rings or other devices first, because a lot of people use those at night to help them monitor their sleep and see their sleep quality. And with Oura Rings, you could like turn off the Bluetooth. But yeah, just I wanted to get your opinion if you think that there's also risk with those.
Yes. Well, you know, what we know on shifting brain waves is concerning to me when you use wearables to track your sleep, but the Bluetooth technology might be impairing your sleep. It's a bit ironic in how these things are designed. However, the Oura, it's one of the brands that I appreciate because you can keep it on airplane mode while you sleep. So it will store the data locally inside the ring. And I don't know how, but you know, the technology is becoming so small, it's almost ridiculous. But you know, it's just a little bit of data about your heart rate and HRV and body temperature and things like that that are picked up by the sensors. And then in the morning, you can put it out of airplane mode and sync the data to your phone to visualize it and say, you know, how am I feeling right now? How does it corroborate with the data I have, and then put it back on airplane mode. So my amount of exposure I'm getting from the Oura is next to nothing. However, a lot of other types of wearables emit Bluetooth sometimes multiple times per second. So I have a problem with that. I don't think it's well designed. And I think that if the technology can be designed in a way that it stores the data locally and it just will dump the data or sync the data once per day or on demand, if it can be done, why aren't all types of wearables built this way? And I think it's just poor engineering, and I would recommend against it. And maybe there are occasions where you want to track your sleep with certain sleep tracking devices that emit Bluetooth, and you do it for a month and then you discontinue the use. I wouldn't be completely against it, but chronic prolonged exposure would be a problem because I don't think it's going to serve you well.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Nick, for sharing this and all the other information. And before we wrap things up, is there anything else that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you? Anything else that you wanted to summarize?
Well, I mean, if we want to summarize how to reduce exposure quickly, is just to focus on the bedroom first. And that's really something I remind people is there are really two things we can talk about when it comes to exposures. If you start playing around with a meter and go over every machine, everything emits EMFs. So it's hard to think about what is your priority here. Living in the woods, go hide in the cave, it doesn't work really for most people. So in reality, look at what is inside your bedroom and that could be contributing to these exposures at night. And then where are you spending most of your time during the day? For some people, if they're a home office, if it would be my dad, for example, he's a realtor, so it would be his car. He's in the car 3 hours per day minimum, sometimes more. So for him, it would be maybe turning off the Bluetooth function in the car and, you know, pre-downloading songs or podcasts on his cell phone. I don't think he's going to do it, but still, I have to keep trying and trying to educate him. So really think about where you're spending most of your time and focus there. If you start to think about all EMF exposures, it's like being concerned over all toxins. It doesn't work. You have to prioritize. And in that case, just making sure that you tackle the bedroom and then where you're spending a lot of time, I think you're going to be 90% of the way there.
Well, wonderful advice. Thank you so much for sharing. And where can people find out more about you? Feel free to share your website. And then also, if you could talk about your upcoming EMF Hazard Summit.
Sure, tremendous. So theemfguy.com, so theemfguy.com is where people can find me. There's my book, courses, and whatnot. And then the EMF Hazard Summit 2024 will be live from April 11th and 14th. And it is focused this year on the what I call the hidden epidemic of electrosensitivity. So we give people 20 different talks that are focused on electrosensitivity. We have presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's one of the headliners. We also have environmental medicine doctors that are specialized in treating EMF sensitive patients. So that's very rare that we can find these doctors that have the medical expertise to diagnose electrosensitivity and then that have figured out how can we get these people to a place where they feel better. And of course, regardless of if you feel better or not, you should still lower EMFs. But for some people, the level of EMF reduction that they require to feel well is completely unattainable in a city. So they cannot really live in society anymore. And their life choices are that much more reduced by their circumstances. So how can they go back to a good health and a good level of sensitivity where they can still travel? They can take a car and go see a friend, or maybe they can spend a few days in a city that they want to visit. So it's for people that feel electrosensitive or maybe don't know if they are electrosensitive or not. And again, April 11 to 14, and I think you're going to have links right next to the interview somewhere in your newsletters and whatnot. And I'm very happy for this third annual edition. I think it's the best yet, and I can't wait to get your feedback.
Yeah, I definitely will include links in the show notes. And yeah, I'm very excited as well. And thank you. Thank you again, Nick, so much, not only for this interview, but for the research that you've done, for the upcoming summit, the past summits you've done, just spreading the awareness. I think it's such an important topic. And again, just appreciate everything you do.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me and helping spreading the word the way you're doing it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Save My Thyroid podcast. If you haven't done so already, make sure you hit subscribe to stay up to date on the latest thyroid health related topics. And to get your free thyroid and immune health restoration action points checklist, visit SaveMyThyroidChecklist.com. Thanks so much for tuning in.
So that was an awesome interview with Nick. obviously a very important topic since we're exposed to EMFs pretty much all the time, and we can't completely eliminate our exposure, but we can do a lot to reduce our exposure, which is what this conversation was about. And so as far as safe dose of EMFs, so we compared it to lead, where really we don't know. We don't know what the safe dose is. I mean, lead, we know, I mean, really any heavy metal, whether it's lead, mercury, cadmium, the least amount of exposure, the better. And arguably that's the case with any environmental toxin. And we don't really think the same way of electronic pollution, but we really should. We really just want to try to minimize our exposure. Again, we're not going to completely eliminate our exposure, but just try to get it as low as we can. And then shielding. So shielding, you mentioned, can help, but you still want to do things to minimize exposure. You don't want to just rely on the shielding alone. And I admit I don't do as much as I can when it comes to shielding, even though I do try to do things to minimize exposure. I could do better when it comes to shielding. EMFs and fertility. So you mentioned how EMFs can affect hormones, especially testosterone, causing low testosterone, can also affect sperm quality. And again, how much exposure to EMFs is necessary before it affects fertility? I don't think he mentioned it, but again, all you could do is try to minimize your exposure, but you could do a lot, especially in your own home. So just really focus, especially on your own home and your bedroom, especially if you're trying to conceive. But even if you're not, you really want to do everything you can in your home to try to lower exposure to EMFs. EMFs and thyroid cancer. He also mentioned there was some evidence in this area as well. I think it's safe to say that probably most of the thyroid cancer cases out there probably are not due to exposure to EMFs. But even if it's a very small percentage, you still want to minimize exposure. And I think without question, the increased incidence in thyroid cancer and other types of cancers related to environmental toxins. And again, more so probably things like xenoestrogens, for example, and other environmental pollutants. But again, we just tend to overlook the impact of electronic pollution. Sleep disruption. So EMFs definitely can impact one's sleep. And it's easy enough to unplug the Wi-Fi at night and to try to stop using electronic devices at least an hour, if not 2 hours before going to bed. Again, pretty good about unplugging the Wi-Fi. I can't say that I do an amazing job when it comes to, well, I mean, it depends on the night as far as minimizing exposure before going to bed. I mean, if I have a hosting a coaching call for patients, or if I'm hosting a live event like a 5-day challenge and doing some evening live events, then I might end the call and then 30 minutes to 45 minutes later go to bed. I mean, very rarely am I on the computer, turn it off, and then go to bed. And of course, a lot of people are on their cell phone in bed. So I definitely would try not to do that. And again, some nights I do a real good job. I mean, 2 hours, again, I can't say I consistently avoid electronics devices 2 hours before. I try my best an hour before. And again, I'm not perfect with that. And if you're not perfect, you probably won't be perfect. I won't be perfect, but just again, try just something to work on. Hiring a building biologist is also something that Nicholas chatted about. And I can't say I have hired a certified building biologist, but I did hire someone a few years ago who was striving to be one. At least she had her sights on it. I forgot if she was going through the certification, but she came to our house and she did a mold inspection. And she said mold, according to her, that it was okay in the home, but EMFs, there were room for improvements. I thought that was helpful. And again, she wasn't certified. There is a website, buildingbiologyinstitute.org, where you could look for an expert. I went on there and you could look for a building biology environmental consultant or an electromagnetic radiation specialist. Now, of course, you could just also purchase your own EMF meter and just try to do it on your own. And that's probably more cost effective. And the good thing about an EMF meter is once you have it, you could use it all the time. I mean, hopefully use it and then you find the areas where you need to reduce it and then you retest. So it's not something you should really be using all the time in your home, because once you do an initial screen, you're going to know what areas are higher in EMFs, and then hopefully you'll take action to reduce the exposure, and then you could use the EMF meter to measure again, or again, you could hire an expert to come by. And then I asked him about aura rings, and he was actually wearing an Oura Ring. So he said that exposure is minimal, especially when in airplane mode. He was a little bit critical about other sleep wearables, other devices during sleep. And so I can't blame him because, again, that's what I was just talking about, trying to minimize exposure right before going to bed. And then definitely while sleeping, it's a good idea to avoid electronics as much as you can. I asked him about turning your cell phone on airplane mode, if that's enough. And he said, just make sure that Bluetooth is off as well as Wi-Fi, because you could have it in airplane mode, but those might be on. And even if that's the case, maybe you don't want it still to be really close to you. So just really a great conversation, just really interesting. And again, if you want more information, highly recommend attending his EMF summit. I've been to a few of them. He's had a few. Lloyd Burrow, who was on the podcast in the past. Again, as far as the ones I've attended, they're always good. So I shouldn't even say usually. They're always good. I think you'll get a lot out of attending. And hopefully you found our conversation to be helpful. And as usual, I look forward to catching you in the next episode. I want to let you know about a product called Hepatoimmune Supreme, which is a unique supplement that has a rare combination of N-acetylcysteine, also known as NAC, milk thistle, and schisandra to support the liver. And it also has a few mushrooms that can help support the immune system, including cordyceps, which has both immune modulating and adaptogenic properties and is great for those with Graves' disease and Hashimoto's. To learn more about Hepatoimmune Supreme, visit SaveMyThyroid.com/liver support.